Here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Welcome back to Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, your host, Robert Louis Abrahamson. For variety, we've chosen a different version of Vivaldi's Winter Largo, this time played by Yitzhak Perlman, a little more upbeat with the pizzicato more pronounced. This evening under lamplight, we'll continue our focus on different kinds of ballads, and I hope you'll be caught by some of what we have for you this time. And certainly, as you know, you are invited to attend. Now come back, Yitzhak. All right, and next, as we have been doing, let's attend once more to Alec Guinness reading from the passage in T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets that gives us the name of our show.
Home is where one starts from. As we grow older, the world becomes stranger, the pattern more complicated of dead and living. Not the intense moment isolated with no before and after, but a lifetime burning in every moment, and not the lifetime of one man only, but of old stones that cannot be deciphered. There is a time for the evening under starlight, a time for the evening under lamplight, the evening with the photograph album. Love is most nearly itself when here and now cease to matter. Old men ought to be explorers. Here and there does not matter. We must be still and still moving into another intensity for a further union, a deeper communion through the dark cold and the empty desolation, the wave cry, the wind cry, the vast waters of the petrel and the porpoise. In my end is my beginning.
The pattern more complicated of dead and living, not the intense moment isolated with no before and after, but a lifetime burning in every moment. That's our lead in this evening as we begin with one of the best known Scottish ballads, Edward, Edward, which dramatizes an intense moment of confrontation between a mother and her son, which gradually reveals a very complicated pattern of dead and living. This moment, and the action Edward has just carried out, is not an intense moment isolated with no before and after. It reveals, though indirectly, a complex pattern that had come before this moment and the dire consequences that come after this moment. There's a whole lifetime burning in this moment. Everything led up to it, everything from here on will lead out from it. As I've said before, the Scottish ballads present stories, but almost always with parts left out, with gaps, leaving it for us to fill in and create a coherent narrative, hints and guesses mostly arising from the dialogue. And in a way, Edward, Edward is a pure ballad, presenting as it does no direct narrative, but only dialogue, back and forth between the mother and her son Edward. We have to imagine what has happened just before the ballad starts. Presumably, the mother has just encountered Edward, perhaps walking in a kind of stupor, with his sword, his brand, as it's called here, his sword drawn and dripping red from some very recent bloodshed. And so the mother asks, in the famous opening line, "Why does your brand say drop with blood, Edward, Edward? Why does your sword so drop with blood?" And Edward's answer, sounding very casual, "Oh, I've just killed my hawk so good, and I have no mare but heo." No, the mother doesn't buy this. The hawk's blood was never so red. I'm not sure how she knows this, but never mind. "Okay," he says, "okay, I've just killed my horse, my red roan steed." "Well, that wouldn't make you so upset," she says. "Your steed was old and you've got mare. You've got more. But it's nothing to be so sad about." And then the great line, "Some other duel ye dree. You're suffering from some other grief." And then the dialogue pivots. He tells her the truth. "I ha' killed my feather dear. Alas, and woe is me. I've killed my dear father. Woe is me. Vey is mere." And as we've said, this is no moment isolated from past or future. And now the mother shifts from asking about the past, what he had done, to the future, what he plans to do next. "What penance will you do for that?" she asks. "I'll set my feet in yonder boat, and I'll fare over the sea." "Okay, a good penance, I suppose. Suffer exile from all he holds dear. But what about your towers and your hall? What will you do with them when you leave?" His bitter reply, "I'll let them stand till they doon fa', till they fall down." And her next question, "What about your bairns and your wife, your children and your wife? What will you leave for them?" And his next bitter reply, "The world's room, let them beg through life, for them never mair will I see." He's a broken man and has already severed all concern for the rest of the world. But why is he so bitter? Maybe the next few lines will give us a hint. Because there's one more person he's leaving, and here comes her final question, the question she's been holding back all this time. "And what will you leave to your ain mother dear, my dear son? Now tell me." And his reply, which ends the dialogue and the poem, "The curse o' hell frae me shall ye bear, sic counsels ye gave to me. The curse of hell from me shall you bear, such counsels you gave to me." And that's it. Except that I've only given the bare bones of what they're saying, and as we know, meaning arises as much from the form as from the content, and I've left out a very important part of the form. The mother keeps repeating, "Edward, Edward," and he keeps repeating, "Mother, Mother." A kind of useless repetition, taking up time, we might feel, when we want to get on with the story. But that's just our modern short attention span. Attend to how the repetition works in a good reading, and also to the repetition of "O" at the end of every stanza. So here again is C.R.M. Brooks reading Edward, Edward.
"Why does your brand say drop with blood, Edward, Edward? Why does your brand say drop with blood? And why say sad gang ye, oh? Oh, I ha' killed my hawks again, mother, mother. Oh, I ha' killed my hawks again, and I had nae mare but he, oh. Your hawk's blood was never sae red, Edward, Edward. Your hawk's blood was never sae red, my dear son, I tell ye, oh. Oh, I ha' killed my red roan steed, mother, mother. Oh, I ha' killed my red roan steed that erst was sae fair and free, oh. Your steed was old, and ye hae got mair, Edward. Edward, your steed was old, and ye hae got mair. Some other dool ye dree, oh. Oh, I hae killed my feather dear, mother. Mother. Oh, I hae killed my feather dear. Alas, and wae is me, oh. And what in penance will ye dree for that, Edward? Edward, and what in penance will ye dree for that, my dear son, who tell me, oh? I'll set my feet on yonder boat, mother, mother. I'll set my feet on yonder boat, and I'll fare o'er the sea, oh. And what will ye do with your tours and your haw, Edward, Edward? And what will ye do with your tours and your haw that were so fair to see, oh? I'll let them stand till they doon fa', mither. Mither, I'll let them stand till they doon fa', for here never mair man I be, oh. And what will ye leave to your bairns and your wife, Edward? Edward, and what will you leave to your bairns and your wife when ye gang over the sea, oh? The world's room. Let them beg through life. Mother, mother. The world's room. Let them beg through life. For them never mair will I see, oh. And what will you leave to your ain mother dear, Edward? Edward, and what will you leave to your ain mother dear? My dear son, who tell me, oh. Curse of hell from me shall ye bear, mother. Mother, the curse of hell from me shall ye bear. Sic counsels ye gave to me, oh.
Sic counsels ye gave to me, oh. What counsels were these? Surely this is the key to the situation, taking us back to all that led up to his murder of his father. What, was the mother poisoning the son over the years, feeding his resentment of his father, building up his hopes of inheriting all the castles and lands, getting the son to avenge some wrong the mother felt her husband had done to her? Well, of course, we'll never know, and that's the power of this ballad. All we have is the present moment, this short dialogue. Not the intense moment isolated with no before and after, as T.S. Eliot put it, but a lifetime burning in every moment. I couldn't find any musical version appropriate for us here, so we'll just leave it there for now and cleanse our palate with a wee promenade through the gallery, a different one of the promenades from our usual choice. Okay, and now for another ballad, this time from Leonard Cohen. A good follow-up to Edward Edwards, since this ballad, too, is composed, well, almost exclusively of dialogue between a captain and the person telling us the story, a young corporal. We're given a brief scene setting at the start. Now the captain called me to his bed. He fumbled for my hand. And then the dialogue begins. This captain apparently is dying, and he's passing the command over to the speaker. But it's an entirely absurd situation, since there's only the two of them there. What kind of command is he being given? And then the appalling but utterly memorable line from the captain, "Complain, complain, that's all you do ever since we lost. If it's not the crucifixion, then it's the Holocaust." How do you go on after this remark from a dying man? "May Christ have mercy on your soul," the young man replies, "for making such a joke amid these hearts that burn like coal and the flesh that rose like smoke." This, we're beginning to perceive, is an end-of-the-world apocalyptic moment, some kind of end-game version of a Beckett play. Okay, he says, I'm leaving. I'm getting out of here. But tell me, Captain, if you know of a decent place to stand. I don't think he should have asked that, since the answer is almost beyond endurance. There is no decent place to stand in a massacre. But if a woman take your hand, then go and stand with her. Huh? How did she suddenly get in here? Is this just, as he wonders, just some country western song? Stand by your woman or something? Good, says the captain, you've passed the test. You're disillusioned and cynical enough to think standing with a woman is just a sentimental country western song. Come over here, then, and stand with me. Oh, no, the young man says, your standing days are done. You'll rally me no more. I don't even know what side we fought on or what for. But the captain knows, and this is his final message to the young man. I'm on the side that's always lost, he says, against the side of heaven. I'm on the side of snake eyes tossed against the side of seven. And I've read the Bill of Human Rights, and some of it was true, but there wasn't any burden left, so I'm laying it on you. Is this captain then the devil, or just some devil's man? Is he saying that the Bill of Human Rights is no longer a burden because it's so generally ignored in these end times? So what then is he laying on the young man? Can we know? Or is this just another intense moment, not isolated with no before and after, but a lifetime burning in every moment? In fact, are we always in the position of this young man, facing the apparent meaninglessness of life, always on the losing end, inheriting cursed burdens rather than blessings? What can he do? We're given no indication of his motive here, but the final stanza returns to the narrative and bluntly tells us, now the captain, he was dying, but the captain wasn't hurt. The silver bars were in my hand. I pinned them to my shirt. He takes command of no one, just an empty, burned-out world. Well, yes, but what about the form of the ballad? What about that honky-tonk piano and the jaunty beat, the accordion and the violin? What do they add to it all? Well, attend and see what you think.
Now the captain called me to his bed. He fumbled for my hand. Take these silver bars, he said, I'm giving you command. Command of what? There's no one here, there's only you and me. All the rest are dead or in retreat or with the enemy. Complain, complain, that's all you've done ever since we lost. If it's not the crucifixion, then it's the Holocaust. May Christ have mercy on your soul for making such a joke. Amid these hearts that burn like coal and the flesh that rose like smoke. I know that you have suffered, lad, but suffered this a while. Whatever makes a soldier sad will make a killer smile. I'm leaving, Captain, I've got to go. There's blood upon your hand. But tell me, Captain, if you know of a decent place to stand. There is no decent place to stand in a massacre. But if a woman take your hand, then go and stand with her. I left a baby in Saigon. I'll risk my life but not to hear some country western song. Ah, but if you cannot raise your love to a very high degree, then you're just the man I've been thinking of. So come and stand with me. Your standing days are done, I cried, you'll rally me no more. I don't even know what side we fought on or what for. I'm on the side that's always lost against the side of heaven. I'm on the side of snake eyes tossed against the side of seven. And I've read the Bill of Human Rights and some of it was true, but there wasn't any burden left, so I'm laying it on you. Now the captain, he was dying, but the captain wasn't hurt. The silver bars were in my hand, I pinned them to my shirt.
That was Leonard Cohen's rollicking end-of-the-world nightmare ballad, The Captain. He puts the two silver bars, the badge of a captain, onto his shirt and takes over command of no one as the world diminishes and he is left a figure of absurdity, perhaps a clown figure of absurdity as the music fades away. And now for another ballad. Another, we might say, another Jewish country western pastiche. This one less puzzling, but perhaps more disturbing. I hesitated about whether I could play this on the air. It's a very sensitive topic, much more sensitive than it was when Kinky Friedman wrote the song back in the late 60s. The song is The Ballad of Charles Whitman, and it celebrates, laments, it's hard to know exactly what it does about Charles Whitman, the first mass murderer in this long spate of awful shootings in America during the past 50 years. The song will probably, like many of Kinky Friedman's songs, offend some people, many people, most people, I don't know. And it can seem to be poking fun at mass murders. But after some consideration, I have concluded that it's better to attend to the song than to ignore it, if only to see the way such incidents were treated back then, and to try to get a sense of what the satiric object of the song could be. And is this satiric object still applicable today? Well, on August 1st, 1966... Charles Joseph Whitman, 25 years old, a clean-cut honors student and an Eagle Scout, a married man, a former U.S. Marine with certificates in sharpshooting, but with a history of gambling, carrying weapons illegally, and abuse of other Marines, doing postgraduate work in architecture, well, he went to his mother's apartment and calmly and quickly killed her, and then killed his wife in her sleep to spare them the shame of what he was about to do, and then went up to the 28th floor observation deck of the main building of the University of Texas at Austin, where he was a student, and in 96 minutes shot and killed 13 people and injured 31 others before police shot him dead. He expected to die and even wrote a suicide note, part of which said, "I do not quite understand what it is that compels me to type this letter. Perhaps it is to leave some vague reason for the actions I have recently performed. I do not really understand myself these days. I am supposed to be an average, reasonable, and intelligent young man. However, lately, I cannot recall when it started, I have been a victim of many unusual and irrational thoughts. These thoughts constantly recur, and it requires a tremendous mental effort to concentrate on useful and progressive tasks. An autopsy later revealed a tumor in his brain, but no one, apparently, has ever conclusively connected this tumor to the mental disturbance that resulted in such insane violence. Kinky Friedman grew up in Austin, Texas, so this was a local incident for him, something he probably had to come to terms with. Well, who didn't? And he does this by turning the incident into some kind of jolly event, seeming to make fun of the horror, as in the first stanza. He was sitting up there for more than an hour, way up there in the Texas Tower, shooting from the 27th floor. He didn't choke or slash or slit them, not our Charles Joseph Whitman. And he won't be an architect no more. There's something a little nervous about this, as though Kinky doesn't really know how to respond, and much of the song is taken up with the various ways people did respond. Some people, for instance, shouting, "Texas number one!" as though any kind of excitement was a cause for Texas chauvinism. And the administration's inappropriate, insensitive response. But as he concludes, most folks couldn't figure just why he did it, and them that could would not admit it. There's still a lot of Eagle Scouts around. As though all these Eagle Scouts were denying that there could be anything wrong with their clean-cut, repressed, straight, white American culture. Now here's what Kinky himself said about the song. "I wrote The Ballad of Charles Whitman shortly after the incident. I'm sure the people who didn't like it thought I was mocking a tragedy or something, but they didn't listen to the song. It explores the mind of Charles Whitman and what makes these things happen. The question is, why? Why would somebody do that? He was a straight-A student, an Eagle Scout, a Marine, just a good all-around, all-American asshole. I doubt if his neighbors thought he was evil. That's usually how it is. He was not without his charm. We profess to find it deplorable, but we're fascinated because there's a little bit of Charlie in us all. We're all capable of terrible acts, and we're all capable of greatness. It's a question of which angels we're listening to, I suppose." Well, so, keep in touch with your good angels. Don't jump to any quick answers. Be flexible enough for a grim smile amidst the horror, and attend to the Ballad of Charles Whitman.
He was sitting up there for more than an hour, way up there on the Texas Tower, shooting from the 27th floor. He didn't choke or slash or slit them, not our Charles Joseph Whitman. He won't be an architect no more. Got up that morning, calm and cool. He picked up his guns and walked to school. All the while he smiled so sweetly, and it blew their minds completely. They'd never seen an Eagle Scout so cruel. Now what you think of the shame and degradation for the school's administration, who put on such a bold and brassy show? The chancellor cried, "It's adolescent, and of course it's most unpleasant, but I gotta admit it was a lovely way to go." There was a rumor about a tumor nestled at the base of his brain. He was sitting up there with his 36 Magnum, laughing wildly as he bagged him. Who are we to say the boy's insane? Charlie was awful disappointed. Elsie thought he was anointed to do a deed so low down and so mean.
The students looked up from their classes, had to stop and rub their glasses. Who'd believe he'd once been a Marine? Now Charlie made the honor roll with ease. Most all of his grades was A's and B's. Rear rip, snorting, trigger, squeezer. Charlie proved a big crowd pleaser, though he had been known to make a couple of C's. Some were dying, some were weeping, some were studying, some were sleeping, some were shouting, Texas number one. Some were running, some were falling, some were screaming, some were bawling, some thought the revolution had begun. The doctors tore his poor brain down, but not a snitch of illness could be found. Most folks couldn't figure just why he did it, and them that could would not admit it. There's still a lot of Eagle Scouts around. There was a rumor about a tumor nestled at the base of his brain. He was sitting up there with his 36 Magnum, laughing wild as he bagged him. Who are we to say the boy's in? Who are we to say the boy's in? Who are we to say the boy's insane?
Who are we to say the boy's insane? But then what? If not insane, then is it that culture he was raised in? Is it the availability of guns? Well, notice that the issue of gun control didn't even occur to people at that time. The song isn't really a ballad by most definitions, but my sense is that Kinky called it the Ballad of Charles Whitman to elevate the incident, giving it the mythic importance equal to, say, the Ballad of Davy Crockett, which we heard last time. As though understanding that America was so starved for any kind of sensationalism that even a mass murderer could be elevated to a kind of heroic or anti-heroic stature just because he had done something quite out of the ordinary. The fact that it was a horrible act of violence just attracted people all the more to the incident and elevated the man as a figure of importance. Does this elevation of mass murderers still operate today? Well, the immediate clamor is probably even greater today than in the 1960s, but perhaps because these incidents arise so quickly, one after another, the media tends to drop its coverage, and the public is happy to move on to other pieces of exciting novelty. Do you remember who perpetrated the Las Vegas killings a short while ago? How about the recent shootings in a school in Texas? Or any of the others? Is it a good thing that we no longer turn mass murderers into ballad heroes? Is there anyone around today that we'd want to make the hero of a ballad, even a satiric ballad? If you can think of a present-day ballad celebrating someone worth attending to, let me know at lamplight at cambridge105.co.uk. That's our email for Evening Under Lamplight, and it will come to me, your presenter, Robert Louis Abrahamson, here on Cambridge 105 Radio, this evening, inviting you to attend to more balladry.
When the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend Evening Under Lamplight. It's Cambridge 105 Radio.
Thank you. Now, next, we move over to Dylan with another ballad set in that mythic world of the American West. Another Jewish country song, if we can say this. Lily, Rosemary, and the Jack of Hearts, one of my favorites. The song follows the ballad tradition in telling us a story, but only in bits and pieces, never a continuous narrative. The mysterious figure known only as the Jack of Hearts, or we might say the Knave of Hearts, has come into this unnamed town, apparently the head of a gang of bank robbers, and while the rest of the gang is drilling in the wall, the Jack of Hearts moves into the cabaret where things are pretty dead. The gambling wheel, for instance, is now shut down since the festival is over. But the bar is still open, and there's a stage show about to be performed. And this, then, is the intense moment, not isolated, with no before and after, but a lifetime burning in every moment. But what has come before? We only get hints. What connections in the past have there been between Lily and the Jack of Hearts? What's the history of that triangle between Big Jim, Rosemary, the Queen, and Lily, the Princess? What's going to happen at the end when the whole set of relationships has been destroyed and life, it seems, is ready to move into a new chapter? Well, the way Dylan gives us only hints is wonderful. I've seen lots of people on the internet trying to push the ballad further, looking for hidden meanings behind each of the characters, making the whole thing out to be a commentary on capitalism or something. Sometimes this kind of digging is fruitful, but not here, I'm certain. Ballads do not carry symbolic overtones. They just tell a story in their own way. The meaning lies in the storyline and the interrelation of the characters, the before and after burning in each intense moment. And then the other element of the song, the music. No other song makes me jump with excitement the way the music in this song does. First of all, there's the bass with its steady, persistent, unvarying beat, moving us along as in a dance, round and round or up and down the line, and the drum accompanying this unvaried pace, though occasionally slipping in a little variation, which, if we can catch it, adds an extra sparkle to what's going on. And the organ, moving steadily through the song, but varying its pitch and rhythm in response to the changes in the meter of the verses. Oh yes, and the verses. There's Dylan's usual deft handling of rhymes, and each stanza somehow maneuvering so it ends with Jack of Hearts. But more than that, there's Dylan's extraordinary handling of meter, especially the way he throws in three stressed syllables in a row. It was known all around that Lily had Jim's ring, or Rosemary on the gallows she didn't even blink, or was looking to do just one good deed before she died. In the official lyrics to the song, there's a line that goes, "Lily washed her face, took her dress off, and buried it away." But when Dylan sings it, his instinct alters it for the better, dropping the first part so the second part has to be elongated in compensation. And we get, "Lily took her dress off, buried it away." It's just her dress, but everything associated with it, including two people, end up being buried away, just like so much else in the story. This playing with the meter is what makes the dance of this song so exciting. A dance becomes monotonous if it has no variation, and there's just enough variation here to keep us dancing in excitement. See what I mean? Lily, Rosemary, and the Jack of Hearts, going out specially for Jessica, who lived with this song over one stretch of her life.
Except for the drilling in the wall, the curfew had been lifted and the gambling wheel shut down. Anyone with any sense had already left town. He was standing in the doorway, looking like the Jack of Hearts. He moved across the mirrored room, set it up for everyone, he said. Then everyone commenced to do what they were doing before he turned their heads. Then he walked up to a stranger and he asked him with a grin, "Could you kindly tell me, friend, what time the show begins?" Then he moved into the corner, face down like the Jack of Hearts. Backstage, the girls were playing five cards, stood by the stairs.
Lily had two queens. She was hoping for a third to match her pair. Outside the streets were filling up, the window was open wide. A gentle breeze was blowing, you could feel it from inside. Lily called another bet and drew up the jack of hearts. Big Jim was no one's fool, he owned the town's only diamond mine. He made his usual entrance, looking so dandy and so fine. With his bodyguards and silver cane in every harem place, he took whatever he wanted to and he laid it all to waste. But his bodyguards and silver cane were no match for the jack of hearts. Rosemary combed her hair and took a carriage into town. She slipped into the side door, looking like a queen without a crown. She fluttered her false eyelashes and whispered in his ear, "Sorry, darling, that I'm late," but he didn't seem to hear. He was staring into space over at the jack of hearts. I know I've seen that face somewhere, Big Jim was thinking to himself. Maybe down in Mexico or a picture up on somebody's shelf. But then the crowd began to stamp the feet and the house lights did dim. And in the darkness of the room there was only Jim and him, staring at the butterfly who just drew the jack of hearts. Lily was a princess, she was fair-skinned and precious as a child. She did whatever she had to do, she had that certain flash every time she smiled. Broken home and lots of strange affairs, with men in every walk of life which took her everywhere. But she never met anyone quite like the jack of hearts. The hanging judge came in unnoticed and was being wined and dined. The drilling in the wall kept up but no one seemed to pay it any mind. Except maybe the jack of hearts. Rosemary started drinking hard and seeing her reflection in the knife. She was tired of the attention, tired of playing the role of Big Jim's wife. She had done a lot of bad things, even once tried suicide. Was looking to do just one good deed before she died. She was gazing to the future, riding on the jack of hearts. Lily took her dress off, married it away. As your luck ran out, she laughed at him. Well, I guess you must have known it would someday. Be careful not to touch the wall as a brand new coat of paint. I'm glad to see you're still alive, you're looking like a saint. Down the hallway footsteps, we're coming for the jack of hearts. The backstage manager was pacing all around by his chair. There's something funny going on, he said, I can just feel it in the air. He went to get the hanging judge, but the hanging judge was drunk. As the leading actor hurried by in the costume of a monk, there was no actor anywhere better than the jack of hearts. No one knew the circumstance, but they say that it happened pretty quick. The door to the dressing room burst open and a cold revolver clicked. Jim was standing there, you couldn't say surprised. Rosemary right beside him, studying her eyes. She was with Big Jim, but she was leaning to the jack of hearts. Two doors down,
The boys finally made it through the wall and cleaned out the bank safe. It said they got off with quite a haul. In the darkness by the riverbed, they waited on the ground for one more member who had business back in town. For they couldn't go no further without the Jack of Hire. The next day was hanging day. The sky was overcast and black. Big Jim lay covered up, killed by a penknife in the back. On the scene missing was the Jack of Hearts. The cabaret was empty now. A sign said closed for repair. Lily had already taken all of the dye out of her hair. She was thinking about her father, who she very rarely saw. Thinking about Rosemary and thinking about the law. But most of all, she was thinking about the Jack of Hearts.
Bob Dylan, Lily, Rosemary, and the Jack of Hearts. I've got lots more to say, but there's no time. It's sparkling stuff. Give that man a Nobel Prize or something. But perhaps it's not a good idea to end the show with sparkling stuff. Let's calm things down with another Dylan ballad, the Ballad of Frankie Lee and Judas Priest. It follows the ballad pattern by giving us just a storyline, no chorus or refrain or bridge, just a steady progression of eight-line stanzas, every other line rhyming, straight narration alternating with cryptic language, cryptic dialogue. There are teasing hints that more is meant by the song, especially with the character named Judas, or more suggestively, Judas Priest. The action is sparse. Frankie Lee needs money. His best friend Judas Priest hands him a roll of tens and tells him, "Take your pick, Frankie boy. My loss will be your gain." Frankie asks for a bit of privacy as he chooses which of the $10 bills he'll take, and Judas heads off down the road to eternity, he says, though you might call it paradise. Frankie then gets a message that Judas is stranded in a house down the road. Frankie rushes to the house, though Judas tells him it's not a house, it's a home. Reminiscent of the film A House Is Not a Home, about a woman who runs a house of ill repute. Well, Frankie goes crazy when he sees a woman looking out of each of the 24 windows, and he bounds up the stairs to begin his midnight creep for 16 days and nights, and finally bursting out into the arms of Judas Priest, which is where he died of thirst. End of story. But there's an afterword in which the little neighbor boy, helping to carry Frankie to rest, mutters underneath his breath, "Nothing is revealed." But wait, it's not over. Unlike most ballads, this one has a moral, though its connection to the actual story isn't very clear. Well, the moral of the story, the moral of this song, is simply that one should never be where one does not belong. So when you see your neighbor carrying something, help him with his load. And don't go mistaking paradise for that home across the road. Got it? No? No, of course not. Nothing is revealed, remember? But it's a good moral, isn't it? When you see your neighbor carrying something, help him with his load. And the second moral, don't go mistaking paradise for that home across the road. Don't confuse your true home of your soul with the temporary pleasures just over there across the road. very nice, but we're left to ourselves to work out where the true paradise is and which places on our road are merely the sensuous homes. And what is Judas Priest's role here anyway? Is he a traitor like the biblical Judas, or are we wise to be, skeptical of whatever he does, or is he a commendably fine friend? Well, all we can know is what the little neighbor boy, hiding his guilt, what guilt, mutters, nothing is revealed. Can we live with that and then just immerse ourselves into the song with its playful rhythm and formal structure dancing with colloquial speech? Ballads can do this for us. Attend here.
Well, Frankie Lee and Judas Priest, they were the best of friends. So when Frankie Lee needed money one day, Judas quickly pulled out a roll of tens and placed them on a footstool just above the plotted plain, saying, "Take your pick, Frankie boy, my loss will be your gain." Well, Frankie Lee, he sat right down and put his fingers to his chin, but with the cold eyes of Judas on him, his head began to spin. "Could you please not stare at me like that?" he said. "It's just my foolish pride. But sometimes a man must be alone, and this is no place to hide." Well, Judas, he just winked and said, "All right, I'll leave you here. But you better hurry up and choose which of those bills you want before they all disappear. I'm gonna start my picking right now, just tell me where you'll be." Judas pointed down the road and said, "Eternity." "Eternity," said Frankie Lee, with a voice as cold as ice. "That's right," said Judas, "eternity, though you might call it paradise." "I don't call it anything," said Frankie Lee with a smile. "All right," said Judas Priest, "I'll see you after a while." Well, Frankie Lee, he sat back down, feeling low and mean, when just then a passing stranger burst upon the scene, saying, "Are you Frankie Lee, the gambler, whose father's deceased? Well, if you are, there's a fella calling you down the road, and they say his name is Priest." "Oh, yes, he is my friend," said Frankie Lee in fright. "I do recall him very well. In fact, he just left my sight." "Yes, that's the one," said the stranger, "quiet as a mouse. Well, my message is he's down the road, stranded in a house." Well, Frankie Lee, he panicked, he dropped everything and ran, until he came unto the spot where Judas Priest did stand. "What kind of house is this," he said, "where I have come to roam?" "It's not a house," says Judas Priest, "it's not a house, it's a home." Well, Frankie Lee, he trembled, he soon lost all control over everything which he had made while the mission bells did toll. He just stood there staring at that big house as bright as any sun, with 24 windows and a woman's face in every one. Well, up the stairs ran Frankie Lee with a soulful bounding leap, and foaming at the mouth he began to make his midnight creep. For 16 nights and days he raved, but on the 17th he burst into the arms of Judas Priest, which is where he died of thirst. No one tried to say a thing when they carried him out in jest. Except, of course, the little neighbor boy who carried him to rest. And he just walked along alone with his guilt so well concealed, and muttered underneath his breath, "Nothing is revealed." Story. The moral of this song is simply that one should never be where one does not belong. So when you see your neighbor carrying something, help him with his load. And don't go mistaking paradise for that home across the road.
Dylan's Ballad of Frankie Lee and Judas Priest. A good goodnight song to leave you with. This has been Evening Under Lamplight with Robert Louis Abrahamson on Cambridge 105 Radio. Looking forward to spending time with you again in a fortnight. Good night.